You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, from a kids' cooking competition to a Shasta County ballot fight and a major Medicaid fraud case in Klamath Falls. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
And reporter Jane Vaughn is off today, but we'll start with this conversation Justin recorded with her earlier this week.
Hi, Jane.
Hey, Justin.
So you had a story this week about a cooking competition for kids. Tell me about that.
Yes, it was so much fun and super cute. It's called the Future Chefs Challenge. It's actually a national competition, and it's run by this food service management company called Sodexo, and one of the districts that they serve is Phoenix Talent. And so the goal of the contest is to inspire kids to cook and to get more comfortable in the kitchen, learn some new skills, cook their family recipes, make healthy food, all those good things. They're trying to get kids involved. And the theme this year was Passport to Flavor, so they're trying to get kids to think globally as they come up with their recipes. And they really came up with some very different recipes, a whole range from lasagna to smoothies, and then they cooked them.
Awesome. Well, it sounds like a really cute reality TV show.
Exactly.
How does the competition work?
So it's open for third through fifth graders in the district, and they can submit recipes, and then a certain number of them get chosen to actually cook the dishes. And so there were seven kids competing. They each have an adult staff member who's helping them out and keeping an eye on things. So they were set up in Phoenix High School in either the culinary classroom or the cafeteria. They have about 2 hours, and they have to cook their recipes all from scratch and then plate it, present four plates to the judges. They have to make 50 smaller tasting plates for the attendees to try. It was mostly family members there. And then they have to make one display plate. They make a presentation to the judges who can ask them questions about the recipe. And then the judges pick a winner. And then everyone who participates gets a cookbook and a medal. And then there's also a crowd favorite that gets chosen. So attendees can vote for their favorite recipe. And then the winner actually gets sent on to the national judging for this competition.
And how did the competition go? How was this fun to attend?
It was so much fun. Kids are hilarious. There were a few mix-ups and sort of learning moments. So one student didn't add at all as much flour as was really needed for the recipe. One kid forgot an important step and then remembered and had to kind of backtrack for a minute. There was a lot of very careful chopping with cut gloves. They learned a lot about kitchen safety and hair nets and all that important stuff. One kid, I asked her least favorite part about cooking, and she said it was having to wash her hands all the time, even though she knows that's very important. And so we had a discussion about how important it is to wash your hands a lot when you're cooking. So they learned some important skills. One kid I was talking to quoted from the movie Holes, which was great. I grew up watching that movie. I don't know if you grew up watching that movie, but it made me feel kind of old, but I'm also glad that kids these days are still watching Holes, which is great. So overall, it was just a lot of fun, and the food they made was really impressive, really delicious, so it was a cool event.
And you got to try some of that food.
I did, yeah.
Excellent. Well, we won't spoil who won this competition. We'll have to listen to the story to find that out. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that was a fun little listen there. Now I might have to watch Holes this weekend. Roman, you went down to Reading this week for a court hearing on a ballot measure in Shasta County. What is that ballot measure?
Yeah, it's called Measure B. It would make a bunch of these sweeping changes to the election system in the county. So it would do things like requiring people to present a ID when they go to vote at the polls. It would ban, you know, universal vote by mail, essentially only allow people under certain conditions to vote by mail, require the hand counting of all of the ballots, and there's a bunch of other stuff too. But the big issue with this is that a lot of the things on that ballot measure appear to break state and federal laws. Like there's a state law that was recently passed specifically targeting Shasta County to ban hand counting because Shasta County has tried to do that before. And California also bans counties from requiring voter ID at the polls, and they do also need to provide vote-by-mail ballots to all people.
Okay, so got it about what it's about, but why is there a lawsuit?
Yeah, so this local nurse, Jennifer Katsky, basically is suing. She sued the county in an attempt to keep it off of the June ballot because of these conflicts with the state and federal law. So she believes that, you know, not only would it mislead voters by putting something on the ballot that wouldn't be legal to actually implement, but it would also take attention away from other important elections and waste time and taxpayer money defending it in court if it actually wins. They had a really quick timeline for this lawsuit because the primary, you know, is in June, but the finalized ballots need to be sent to the printer by April 2nd, which is next week. So they really had to get a decision out on this quickly. Initially, the judge had scheduled a hearing after that and had put a pause on the ballot measure, but the proponents of the measure appealed, and so they moved up the hearing to this week.
And what went on at the hearing?
Yeah, it was a 3-hour hearing. It was long, a lot of arguments from both sides. The defendants originally were the county, but they voted not to participate in it. But the proponents of the measure itself were able to intervene and defend it instead. They hired Alexander Haberbusch, who's this Long Beach-based attorney who's been involved in election integrity, stuff like this before. And they were basically arguing it on two major fronts. The first is that they argued that the case is invalid on procedural grounds, not the actual substance of it. And they said that Katsky couldn't point to a specific law that says the clerk is required to pull a ballot measure because it's illegal. So, you know, really there's nothing to sue over because there's nothing the judge could order the clerk to do under the law. And then on the actual issue of the ballot measure, Haberbusch said that it shouldn't be pulled because not all of the ballot measure is illegal. Some of it is actually happening right now, like filming all of the ballots. So they argued that, you know, reviewing this after the election is more appropriate. Katsky was actually defending herself during this lawsuit, and she told me after that she couldn't find a lawyer in the county willing to take on the case.
Here in Shasta County, if you defend a liberal, you defend somebody that doesn't go along with the hard right, it's career suicide. So, you know, I had no choice but to defend myself.
So it was kind of interesting that, I mean, it was difficult because she was going up against a lawyer and she was not as experienced with the law being a nurse.
Yeah. Well, you brought us a decision which came out Thursday morning. What did the judge decide?
Yeah. So he agreed with the defendants pretty much on everything. He threw out the case on those procedural grounds. Said that, you know, Katsky had pointed to one election law, but that law deals with errors or omissions in the measure, not the actual content itself. And then he also outlined his thoughts on reviewing this measure before the election. You know, as we heard in the hearing, and that was a big part of it, is that it's pretty rare for courts to review the measure before the election itself. There's only a couple of cases, you know, when it's happened and a couple of exceptions, essentially, like when a measure was deemed to be outside the scope of what an initiative can do. There was this case in 2001 where voters in San Diego put up this proposition to build a baseball park, but they decided that that was an administrative matter that the city would be doing, not a legislative matter. And the initiatives can only address legislative issues. And then also you could pull a measure from the ballot if it's very clearly in violation of law, like a measure that would, say, legalize murder. That's clearly a violation of the law, so you wouldn't be able to vote on it. But here, you know, in this case, the measure isn't fully clear. It's not fully clear in the legality. Some parts of the measure are legal. There's also a lot of parts to it. So if it was just one specific thing that was clearly illegal, that might be make it easier, but not in this case. So he said it's better to wait until after the election to sue over this measure because also, you know, maybe it won't pass at all. Who knows? Then we won't have to care about it if it doesn't pass. Katsky told me that she's probably not going to sue again after the election, but she did say that, you know, she was happy with the result anyways because her lawsuit has drawn attention to this measure. And, you know, if it passes, there's certainly going to be others willing to take that on.
Okay, thanks, Roman. Justin, you reported on alleged Medicare fraud in Klamath Falls. Tell us about that case.
Yeah, so federal prosecutors charged the owner of a Klamath Falls medical lab with healthcare fraud, and they allege this guy submitted $46 million in fake claims to Medicare Advantage plans. And that was over it's a lot of money, and that was only over a six-month period. And so Medicare Advantage plans are these private Medicare-approved insurance plans you can get. But prosecutors say this person used his business, Oregon Clinical Laboratory in Klamath Falls, to collect more than $28 million from those fraudulent claims. Meaning he was billing Medicare for services like lab tests and then not providing them. It's not clear, you know, if his office was doing anything, actually. Authorities claim...
Except billing Medicare.
Authorities claim he paid people to just check the mail and sit in these storefronts. besides Klamath Falls, he also owned a lab in Utah.
And what do we know about the person accused of this fraud?
So he's a Pakistani national. He came to the United States on a student visa, and then he lost that visa, and he applied for asylum. And he was waiting on a decision for that asylum case. He was living in Southern California while running these businesses in Southern Oregon and in Utah. And authorities tracked him actually to the airport in Los Angeles, where he had bought a one-way ticket to Turkey. Prosecutors think he was eventually heading home to Pakistan. And they arrested him there at the airport right before he boarded the flight. In a court hearing, he requested to be released on bail. And in that request, we learned a little bit more about him. He claims he was actually tricked into the scheme by a friend in Pakistan. He also claims that he had been threatened, so if he didn't help out in the fraud, he was in danger, and that's why he eventually decided to flee the country in fear.
And healthcare fraud is of interest lately in the country. Do you know how investigators identified the case?
Yeah, it seems like people are quite interested in this. There's been some viral sort of social media coverage by some independent journalists. But I think it's important to note that the state and federal government is on the lookout for these kinds of things. We get press alerts for charges all the time. This happened to be a really large amount of alleged fraud, and it was in our coverage area, so that's why we reported on it. And from court documents, it looks like investigators literally just called people named in those claims that were filed mm-hmm. to Medicare and asked them, you know, did you have this service? And no one knew what the lab was and said they didn't receive any lab testing from this place. So that looks like a major investigative technique. I'm not sure why this lab was on authorities' radar. That's something I'd like to know more about. So I've reached out to federal investigators to learn more about that.
Okay. Well, Justin, kind of going in a completely different direction, you also reported on some good news from the Klamath. Tell us about that.
Yeah, good news. So earlier this month, the Klamath Tribe's Fisheries Department documented the first naturally hatched Chinook salmon within the upper Klamath. And so this is the region that was blocked off by dams until pretty recently. In 2024, the last of four dams came down on the Klamath River, which our listeners, I'm sure, know about. It was the largest dam removal project in the country's history. And one reason for this project, this dam removal project, was to bring back the local salmon population, which used the Klamath River historically for breeding. Used to be full of salmon, actually. Last year, researchers documented the first adult Chinook salmon in a tributary of the upper Klamath, and now seeing this newly hatched salmon shows signs that there's an actual self-sustaining population starting and salmon reproducing naturally.
So it's working.
Yeah.
Do you know how they caught this little fish? I mean, it was only an inch or two long.
Yeah, we have a photo on our website. It's very cute, very, very little guy. So researchers used something called a rotary screw trap, and they put these in the Sprague and Williamson Rivers. Those are tributaries that run into the Klamath River. And these traps use the current to open and then capture fish that are moving downstream. And it does this without harming the fish, so that's a pretty neat invention.
And how are local tribes feeling about this?
I spoke with the chairman of the Klamath Tribes, and he was really excited. You know, he talked about what Chinook salmon means to his tribe. Before the dams went up and settlers moved in, salmon were a really important food source, but also really important for medicine and for religious and spiritual and cultural reasons. He said the return of salmon really means the return of some culture that's been lost in the tribes. And it was interesting. He blamed a lot of things happening within his tribe on the loss of salmon. For example, fish once provided a really healthy diet for regional tribes. Mm-hmm. And he said without that, they're seeing high rates of diabetes and hypertension and obesity. You know, he also referred to the Chinook salmon as his relatives, and I think that's common. And he was glad that they were finally returning. So this was really more about just being able to fish again. He really hopes the return of salmon will lead to a cultural rejuvenation for the next generation.
Yeah, and it's interesting that it's more than the health of the salmon population. It's really the health of the tribe and the community there.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, thank you, Justin. That's it for the debrief this week. Thank you for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.